her former Maryland home. In Cambridge, the nearest town, grain brokers and visiting slave traders dominated the local economy. In the unpaved roads of Cambridge, slaveholders swaggered while custom and law hemmed in blacks, free and slave. Philadelphia was more than 20 times larger, with a population in the city of 122,000 by 1850. Tubman might freely wander the sidewalks and find public gardens, as well as private cultural institutions open to her. There were lectures and debates hosted by African Americans at the Rush Library and Debating Society, the Demosthenian Institute, and for women, at the Edgeworth Literary Society. Clarkson Hall, the headquarters of the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society on Cherry Street, doubtless impressed her. There, blacks and whites mixed freely to promote the cause of abolitionism. It was a matter of great pride to blacks in Philadelphia that the Free African Society, founded in April 1787, still flourished. Harriet arrived just as Philadelphia was expanding dramatically. During the 1850s, the city annexed adjoining suburbs to expand the city lines. By 1860, the city included over 500,000 people and claimed to be the fourth largest metropolis in the world, after London, Paris, and New York. This bustling seaport boasted flourishing marine industries, manufacturing, and mercantile interests, which tied the city to a global market. Blacks, as well as whites, played a role in augmenting the economy. By 1850, African Americans in Philadelphia owned real estate totaling over $530,000 and supported such institutions as the Library Company of Colored Persons. When faced with discrimination, the free black community persisted in building its own institutions, insurance societies, cemetery societies, building and loan societies, and separate branches of the Odd Fellows and Masons. The establishment of an upwardly mobile black working class could be seen in the more than 100 mutual benefit societies. Nearly half of Philadelphia's black population were members of one of these organizations. Not long after Harriet arrived, 2,000 black schoolchildren could be found enrolled in 8 segregated public schools and more than 20 charity and private institutions. The emergence of black churches and charities also fostered the perception of opportunity, especially to those newly arrived from slave states. Religion was the principal institutional means for black self-improvement in the antebellum North. Philadelphia flourished as a center for black Christianity and supported a variety of independent black churches, including the Mother Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church at 6th and Lombard, established in 1794. For the first time in her life, Harriet was able to visit a house of worship founded by independent African Americans over half a century earlier. The most powerful early black church in America, the African Methodist Episcopal, had appointed Richard Allen its first bishop in 1816. By the late 1850s, Philadelphia supported nearly 20 African American churches, AME, Baptist, Methodist, and other prominent denominations. Within these sacred walls, black congregations were not only allowed to worship freely, but to speak to the needs for expanding freedoms. Having an open forum to discuss black rights and freedom, to openly challenge slavery, even to plan assistance for runaways and fugitives, all this was revolutionary to Harriet Tubman, and may have partly accounted for the swiftness of her transformation from enslaved to free black woman. While the opportunities and liberties her new home afforded may have initially exhilarated her, slavery's dark side quickly intruded. Free black communities were plagued by terrors reminiscent of the slave catcher fears of Harriet's childhood. The Cannon Gang had been replaced by a new generation of slave stealers, people who made a business of kidnapping free blacks to sell on the auction block. Harriet, as a fugitive slave, was even more vulnerable. Fear of kidnapping was a constant within free black communities in early America, especially for parents of free black children. The narratives of antebellum African Americans are replete with tales of stolen children. Germaine Logan's mother remembered being just a girl of 7 in Ohio when she was dragged against her will into a wagon by a strange man. She recalled several other little colored children in the wagon with her, all destined to be sold off as slaves in Kentucky. Hundreds of free black adults were annually deprived of liberty as well. The Virginia Abolition Society reported to the American Convention in 1800 that it was involved in lawsuits for more than 100 individuals stolen away and could not keep up with rising caseloads. The Protection Society of Maryland was founded in 1816 to prevent these kidnappings, and within 2 years had rescued 60 free blacks from slave stealers. White abolitionist James G. Birney complained that such crimes were carried on without the necessity of secrecy or concealment. Scores of unsuspecting colored persons born free are annually spirited away from the free states and sold into slavery. By the 1830s, too, the prominence and proliferation of African Americans in Philadelphia posed a growing psychological threat to white residents suffering from status anxiety during the antebellum era. Self-improvement within the black community was viewed by many as suspect. Thus, demographic shifts stimulated an increase in race prejudice and mob violence, especially among working-class whites and European immigrants also pouring into the city. The race riot became an irregular eruption within the urban landscape. Philadelphia's reputation as a city plagued by racial strife emerged during the 1830s. One city father bemoaned, "Whoever shall write a history of Philadelphia from the 30s to the era of the 50s will record a popular period of turbulence and outrages so extensive as to now appear almost incredible." A pub fight in 1834 turned into several days of looting and arson in the black neighborhood of Moyamensing, an old Indian term that rather unromantically translates into pigeon excrement. Gangs of white youth roamed the streets of Philadelphia, the blood tubs, the rats, the bouncers, fueling the flames. They described themselves as hunting the niggs. The mayor had to swear in 300 extra constables to try to take back the streets. A year later, in a conscious nod to the Boston Tea Party, angry protesters seized hundreds of abolitionist pamphlets, ripped them to shreds, and dumped their remains into the Delaware River. But Philadelphia's infamy leapt into the national spotlight with the burning of Pennsylvania Hall. On May 14, 1838, in a ceremony highlighted by John Greenleaf Whittier's dedication poem, Pennsylvania Hall officially opened to welcome the second anti-slavery convention of American women, where white and black delegates mingled. Overnight, 15,000 protesters gathered outside the hall. As a matter of public safety, the mayor ordered the building closed on May 16th. That night, arsonists set Pennsylvania Hall afire. The mob cheered as the empty hall burned to the ground, and then rioters moved on to pillage the Mother Bethel AME Church and a colored orphanage. Blacks in Philadelphia became the target of angry whites, who blamed crime and other urban ills on them. African Americans were thrown in jail on petty or trumped-up charges, locked up over foul language and bad conduct. When local justices of the peace were allowed to pocket the fines they imposed, arrests and convictions multiplied. Black abolitionist William Wells Brown complained that color phobia is more rampant here than in the pro-slavery, Negro-hating city of New York. And black leader Robert Purvis echoed, "Press, church, magistrates, clergymen, and devils are against us. The measure of our suffering's full." Doubtless, Harriet Tubman's awareness of the subtleties of race prejudice dawned slowly after the initial rush of enthusiasm for her adopted home. To counter white prejudice, Philadelphia abolitionists commissioned an impressive statistical study, Present State and Condition of the Free People of Color of the City of Philadelphia, 1838. This survey showed that, contrary to unflattering stereotypes, blacks were increasingly upstanding citizens. African Americans contributed to the city's economy, to the market, to the service sector, to booming consumerism. The documentary evidence proved too little, too late. That year, the legislature in Harrisburg drew up a new state constitution, which included prohibition of black male suffrage. Whites charged the whole of the free colored people unworthy of any favor, and claimed they were nuisances in the community, fit only to fill almshouses and jails. This prejudice carried over and prevailed, as racist rants in the popular press became all too common. Who, in fine, is the most protected, the most insolent, the most assuming, the most depraved, the most dangerous of our population? We answer the Negro. The Negro, the Negro. The thick-lipped, woolly-headed, skunk-smelling combination of the monkey and the devil. By the time Harriet arrived in the city, racial vitriol had taken its toll. The overwhelming majority of Philadelphia's African Americans were crowded into poor neighborhoods, with the black per capita value of personal property decreasing 10% in the 1840s. Less than half of 1% of the adult black males in the city were able to find factory jobs. Skilled black labor, which had prospered in Philadelphia the generation after the Revolution, faltered. White artisans and journeymen refused black apprentices in favor of newly arrived Europeans. The rising number of fugitives fleeing from the slave states encouraged Southern congressmen to demand federal protection. Slaveholders complained that the inroads of the Underground Railroad meant a loss of slave property, valued in the neighborhood of $200,000 per year by the late 1840s. Finally, less than a year after she arrived to start a new life in Philadelphia, Harriet was confronted by a piece of legislation that seriously jeopardized her own future and that of thousands of other slaves who had liberated themselves and settled in the North. More than race prejudice, this law would seriously redefine what it meant to be free. On September 18, 1850, Congress approved the Fugitive Slave Law as part of the Compromise of 1850, an omnibus bill designed to settle differences between North and South over the issue of slavery. Blacks and abolitionists nicknamed it the Bloodhound Law. The incendiary issue of fugitive slaves had been debated within the national political arena for more than half a century. The 1793 Fugitive Slave Law had not been particularly effective. Several northern legislatures even passed statutes against kidnapping, aimed at preventing slave catchers from seeking slaves within their states. In 1826, Pennsylvania legislators passed a law that provided for harsh penalties for slave catchers, defined as anyone who should take or carry away from the state any Negro with the intention of selling him as a slave, or of detaining or causing to be detained such Negro as a slave for life. This was overturned in a landmark decision, Prigg versus Pennsylvania, 1842, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Pennsylvania's law was unconstitutional because the owner of a slave is clothed with entire authority in every state in the Union to seize and recapture his slave whenever he can do it without any breach of the peace or any illegal violence. In 1842, George Latimer, a fugitive from Norfolk, was arrested in Boston and threatened with return to Virginia. Bostonians demanded that the city jailer be fired when they discovered he was the slaveholder's agent. Abolitionists prevented Latimer's return to slavery until his owner agreed to sell him. Once the $400 price was paid, Latimer was a free man again. After all the publicity generated by the Prigg versus Pennsylvania decision and the Latimer case, northern legislators decided to tackle the issue with another strategy. Massachusetts prohibited state officials from aiding in the arrest or detention of fugitive slaves, and further declared state jails could not be used for fugitives' confinement. This was nicknamed the Latimer Law. In 1843, Vermont and Ohio adopted similar legislation, followed by Connecticut in 1844, Pennsylvania in 1847, and Rhode Island in 1848. These acts became known as personal liberty laws. After the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, these laws were effectively voided. Local federal commissioners were given sweeping authority in fugitive slave cases. They could deputize, preside over summary hearings, remand captives back south from the furthest reaches of northern cities, and most galling of all, render a verdict without trial by jury. Any resistance to enforcement would result in exorbitant fines. This law may have protected slaveholders' rights to property, but critics howled it was unconstitutional. Commissioners in the North were given financial inducements to get into the slave-catching business. If a black was caught in a dragnet and evidence indicated he or she was indeed an escaped slave, the detaining authorities were paid a fee of $10. If the kidnapper was wrong, the fee was halved. But promising $5 for even a mistaken identity made it open season on northern blacks. Many northern whites, previously on the fence, despised the prospect of upholding slave owning in the flesh, rather than endorsing it in the abstract. They resented being dragooned into defending the rights of slaveholders in their own backyards. In Syracuse, on October 4, 1850, a vocal band of citizens argued the new law was utterly null and void. An October 5th meeting at the African Meeting House in Boston called for the establishment of a League of Freedom to rescue and protect the slave at every hazard. On October 21st, Chicago's City Council passed resolutions to nullify the law within city limits. Underground Railroad activist Thomas Garrett buoyantly predicted to Boston abolitionist leader William Lloyd Garrison, "I very much doubt whether on the whole there will be more arrested under the new law." But this was wishful thinking on his part. In New York City, only 10 days after the law was enacted, James Hamlet became one of the first African Americans seized under new federal guidelines. On September 28, 1850, local authorities plucked him out of a community of 10,000 Manhattan blacks. Alarm spread quickly throughout the city. 30 fugitives decamped to Boston by week's end, and more than 100 relocated to Massachusetts by November 1st. But the Bloodhound Law also threatened blacks in Massachusetts. The Boston Daily Evening Traveler reported, "Quite a number of families, where either the father or mother of fugitives, have been broken up and the furniture sold off with the view of leaving for safer quarters in Nova Scotia or Canada." By October 1850, over 300 African Americans within the relatively small black community of Pittsburgh decided to migrate to Canada. The prospect of the new fugitive slave law's enforcement propelled as many as 3,000 ex-slaves out of their northern homes and into Canada within 90 days. Those who elected to remain in the north decided to take precautions. The Rochester Advertiser reported, "Negroes were pricing and buying firearms with the avowed intention of using them against the ministers of the law, and our orderly citizens should be called upon to aid in executing the fugitive law in our city." In Chicago's small black community, where a little over 500 resided, African American guards patrolled the streets to provide some warning for residents should slave catchers arrive. Frederick Douglass, a former fugitive who eventually bought his own freedom, became the black spokesperson who led the charge against this law. He ticked off a list of 7 other African American leaders who had faltered in the face of this calamity. "We have lost some of our strong men. Ward has been driven into exile. Logan has been hunted from our shores. Brown, Garnet, and Crummel, men who were our pride and hope, we have heard signified their unwillingness to return again to their national field of labor in this country. Bibb has chosen Canada, and the eloquent Remond is silent." Douglass became part of a growing cadre of male ex-slaves drafted by the abolitionist establishment to publicly testify to the horrors of slavery. These first-person accounts were intended to stir up sympathy and to stimulate donations. In 1845, Douglass published his Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. After a tour in England and the purchase of his freedom, he moved to Rochester, New York in 1847. Douglass broke with his former patron, William Lloyd Garrison, and gave voice to his independent abolitionist views with his own newspaper, the North Star. On the matter of the Bloodhound Law, as well as all other matters affecting race relations, Douglass had strong views. His outspoken role in this national debate catapulted him into greater prominence. He argued, "The only way to make the fugitive slave law a dead letter is to make a half dozen or more dead kidnappers." William Lloyd Garrison concurred, "Every fugitive slave is justified in arming himself for protection and defense, and taking the life of every marshal, commissioner, or other person who attempts to reduce him to bondage." An abolitionist editorial declared, "The state motto of Virginia, death to tyrants, is as well the black man's as the white man's motto." By March 1851, more than 60 attempts to recapture fugitives were recorded, with over 100 African Americans involved in these roundups. In the autumn of 1851, 2 spectacular cases burst into the headlines. The first, in rural Pennsylvania, showed ordinary people taking a stand to protect slaves from recapture, and fugitives themselves willing to risk death rather than return to slavery. The second, in Syracuse, featured organized and armed resistance to defy the law. Both were ominous to slaveholders, as well as to federal authorities. Both demonstrated the iron resolve of abolitionists, black and white, to resist injustice and appeal to a higher law. In the first case, two slaves ran away from their master in Maryland. On September 11, 1851, the runaway's owner, Edward Gorsuch, led a posse to the home of William T. Parker, a local black farmer in Christiana, Pennsylvania, where the fugitives were allegedly hiding. When the marshal and Gorsuch's posse approached Parker's home, bugles blared, as horns regularly warned that slave catchers were in the neighborhood. Gorsuch's slaves were at Parker's, but refused to come forward, even after the marshal read out his warrant. A white Quaker neighbor named Castner Hannaway appeared on the scene as a growing crowd responded to the alarm. Hannaway was asked to intercede, but refused. Shortly thereafter, shots were fired. In the ensuing melee, Gorsuch was killed, as were three blacks who participated in the standoff, but the fugitives escaped unharmed. A grand jury in Philadelphia indicted 45 of the Christiana resistors, but when the test case against Castner Hannaway failed to result in conviction, charges against all others were dropped. For radicals, this case ushered in a new era of resistance. With this incident fresh in mind, national delegates from the Liberty Party, the breakaway coalition of Whig and Democratic politicians dedicated to promoting free soil and free labor, gathered for a convention in Syracuse the last week of September 1851. The fugitive slave law was on the agenda, but just as the meeting opened, local federal marshals took a fugitive slave, William Jerry Henry, into custody. If the timing was an accident, it was a very fortuitous accident, both for the fugitive slave and for opponents of the 1850 law. Jerry Henry, as he was known in Syracuse, was far from an ideal candidate for rescue. He was a cooper at a local carpentry shop who had worked in Syracuse for 2 years since his 1849 escape from his Missouri master, but he was also a convicted felon who had tangled with the law and racked up 4 arrests. Frequent police contact may have led to his recapture, as often the local constable, Russell Lowell, wrote to owners and told them where to claim their former slaves. As Jerry Henry was taken into custody on October 1st, church bells rang throughout the city to signal members of the local vigilance committee. When the crowd arrived at the commissioner's office, Henry was being held in handcuffs. In the middle of the hearing, a group of black and white men attempted to free Henry. He was hustled out onto the street, where the sympathetic throng parted to let the ex-slave flee, but blocked the lawmen in pursuit. However, he was finally apprehended and placed in leg irons as well as handcuffs. Under heavy guard, Jerry's hearing resumed at the police station, but it adjourned when a menacing crowd surrounded the building. By evening, local abolitionists were in high gear. Garrett Smith, who would later become a friend and patron of Tubman's, advocated, "A forcible rescue will demonstrate the strength of public opinion. It will honor Syracuse and be a powerful example everywhere." A rescue party, armed with clubs, axes, and a battering ram, consisted overwhelmingly of black faces, largely because most white participants decided to use burnt cork as disguise. When the mob rushed the building, shots were fired, but the attackers refused to back down. They shattered the prison's wooden door, and Jerry's guards fled. The rescued fugitive was bundled into a carriage and given safe passage to Canada. Falling on the heels of the disaster at Christiana, this setback made federal authorities howl. Eventually, 26 men were indicted for their roles in the riot. But when these cases finally went to trial, one man was convicted, another was acquitted. And then, mirroring the outcome at Christiana, the charges against the others were dropped. As one of the participants crowed, "The fugitive, Jerry, is safe in Canada. His Honor the President, Millard Fillmore, has received a nice box by express containing Jerry's shackles. Judge Lawrence, who was so officious in kidnapping Jerry, has been presented by the ladies of Syracuse with 30 pieces of silver, 3-cent pieces, the price of betraying innocent blood." Tubman would have been particularly impressed both by the strength this coalition of free blacks and fugitive slaves manifested and by the assistance white Quakers offered. The failure of the prosecution to obtain a conviction in Pennsylvania would have also raised Tubman's expectations about her new home state. The resistance at Christiana and the legal outcome signaled growing resolve on the part of blacks and whites together to resist the slave power, and the publicity given to the Jerry rescue in Syracuse signaled bolder resistance to come. Yet despite these isolated cases of defiance, the Bloodhound Law also unleashed waves of fear within the African-American community. Free blacks and fugitives alike dreaded the consequences of slave catchers given federal empowerment and the arrest first, ask questions later attitude of white authorities. An abolitionist periodical in Delaware, colorfully named the Blue Hen's Chicken, reported an incident that highlighted black terror. A trio of free blacks traveling with a child were on a southbound train, planning to get off in Newark, Delaware. When they discovered that they had missed their stop and were headed to Maryland, a slave state, they panicked. The young woman was so frightened that sooner than run the risk of going to Maryland, she jumped from the platform, and next followed the man with his child and were safe. His wife's turn came next, but observing her great danger, we seized her by the arm and prevented her, assuring her that we would get her a pass to return when we arrived at Elkton. She implored us to let her go, that she would be arrested and sold into slavery. She fell on her knees and wrung her hands, a more painful or affecting sight we never beheld. Although the black woman made it back safely to Delaware, all who witnessed her abject terror were moved. In the wake of the Fugitive Slave Act, so soon after her arrival in Philadelphia, Harriet Tubman saw this climate of fear mushroom. She had just begun to enjoy the fruits of freedom when the realities of a country divided over slavery became clear. Tubman's growing realization that all people of color, slave, fugitive, or free, in both North and South, were imperiled by the very existence of racial bondage made 1850 a critical turning point in her life, as her own personal journey to freedom expanded to include the aspirations of all slaves. Despite the concrete daily benefits of her new environment, within a year of her arrival, Tubman experienced an increasing sense of deprivation. She suffered the constant ache of loneliness during her time in the North. The line she had once celebrated crossing had become a daunting divide, even as the real border of freedom had moved north to Canada. Harriet would never have traded her new status for her old, but she keenly mourned the separation from her family. Harriet Tubman left little of her emotions or personal details in recorded accounts, yet she once told the poignant story of a man sent to prison for 25 years, a man who spent his time inside his cell, dreaming of home. But upon his release, he leaves the prison gates. He makes his way to his old home, but his old home is not there. The house in which he had dwelt in his childhood had been torn down, and a new one had been put up in its place. His family were gone. Their very name was forgotten. There was no one to take him by the hand to welcome him back to life. About her exile from Maryland, Harriet added, "So it was with me." Chapter 5. The Liberty Lines. Thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto thee. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 15. In the year 1831, the legend goes, a Kentucky slave named Tice Davis escaped his home and headed for freedom in Ohio. During his flight, Davis was being tracked by his master. When he reached the Ohio River, with his master close on his heels, the slave jumped in and swam across. His master, trying to keep his slave in sight, was delayed by seeking a boat. He found one and began to row across, but he watched as Tice Davis scrambled up on shore and vanished. When the master abandoned his search in a nearby town, he told someone that the slave had disappeared so quickly that he must have gone on an underground road. Allegedly, this was the origin of the nickname Underground Railroad. In 1839, a Washington newspaper reported that a young black boy named Jim had been arrested while lurking near the Capitol and would disclose nothing until he was subjected to torture by screwing his fingers in a blacksmithing vise. After a prolonged bout of torture, The frightened young man revealed that he was supposed to go north on a railroad, and the railroad went underground all the way to Boston. This was perhaps the first time that a fugitive network was identified in print both as a railroad and as underground. Within years, such references would become commonplace. Scholars may dispute the role and scope of the UGRR, yet debates over who risked what, when, and how remain an intriguing set of historical questions. First, because of the clandestine nature of the UGRR movement, determining its true scope and extent is hard. There was a dearth of traditional evidence. As a descendant of a Pennsylvania UGRR agent argued, men and women who did their work in daily peril of their fortunes, and perhaps their lives, of course, kept no regular records. Some scholars want to see this fugitive movement as a feud between black rebels and white racists, a battle waged before the war. Others believed the Underground Railroad reflected vanguard elements of a cooperative interracial movement, akin to the civil rights struggle in the mid-20th century. African Americans boldly pioneered, but eventually blacks and whites attacked racial injustice side by side. Of course, in these racial passion plays, though the good guys might have been either black or white, the villains were nearly always white. It was tricky for the majority of blacks during the antebellum era to separate friend from foe. As one African American confided, they, whites, was all devils and good people walking in the road at the same time, and nobody could tell one from t'other. Daniel Gibbons, a white abolitionist whose house was near Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania, frequently sheltered fugitives, was 75 when the Fugitive Slave Law was passed in 1850. Gibbons first became active in helping runaways to freedom in 1824. By 1850, Gibbons had assisted more than 1,000 slaves, recording carefully both the fugitive slave's name and his or her new identity in a journal. But with the Bloodhound Law, Gibbons destroyed 40 pages of lists. These records were not just self-incriminating, but would have revealed the identities of hundreds of fugitives living underground as free blacks in the North. Thomas Garrett was another legendary UGRR station master. Living in Wilmington, Delaware, he doubtless helped Harriet when she escaped Maryland and became her introduction to the machinery of the Liberty Lines, as the routes north on the UGRR were called. Garrett, too, began his rescue work before Tubman was born. One day in 1803, a young free black woman was kidnapped from the rural Pennsylvania Quaker household in which she worked. This girl was wrenched away by two kidnappers who found her easy prey. She was the household servant of a middle-class white family headed by Thomas Garrett Sr. of Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, who supported his 11 children with his mill and tool-making operations. When 24-year-old Thomas Garrett Jr. returned home to find his mother and sisters weeping over the servant girl's fate, he set out to recover her. He found the stolen servant in the kitchen of a tavern in nearby Kensington and brought her back without violence. This was the first of many rescues Garrett would assist. Like many involved in vigilance, he moved from protecting free blacks from kidnappers to helping fugitives on the run to freedom. Again and again, Garrett insisted that he never coerced slaves into running off. Yet he believed it was his duty to help any fugitive sent his way. Garrett joined the Pennsylvania Society for the Promotion of the Abolition of Slavery in 1818. In 1822, he moved with his wife and three young children to Wilmington, Delaware, a thriving crossroads. On Shipley Street, he established a blacksmith shop and a hardware store and ran a cobbling operation. By day, his Wilmington business thrived, while slave smuggling absorbed his energies at night. Garrett became the linchpin of a core group of Delaware abolitionists, primarily Quakers, who assisted fugitive slaves northward. Rescues from the Eastern Shore were promoted by this extensive Wilmington network. Not only Garrett, but also Isaac Flint, John Hunn, Joseph Walker, and a trio of brothers, Benjamin, Thomas, and William Webb, were committed to this new enterprise. They sent most of their cargo, as slaves were called, north to Philadelphia. When a local slaveholder vowed to shoot him on sight, Garrett made a point of going to visit the man and exclaimed, "How does thee do, friend? Here I am, thee can shoot me if thee likes." Once a gang of white Southerners beat Garrett up and threw him off a train he had boarded to rescue a black woman. Garrett dismissed his injuries, commenting he was only slightly bruised by the railing of the cars, but well in a few days. In 1848, he was tried for aiding and abetting slaves and fined $5,000, a sum that wiped him out financially. Despite such setbacks, his devotion to the cause did not waver. Beginning in the mid-1840s, Garrett kept meticulous count of the slaves who passed through his capable hands in Wilmington, Delaware. By the time of the Civil War, this Quaker merchant had lists of more than 2,500 fugitives to whom he had rendered assistance. Clearly, Daniel Gibbons and Thomas Garrett were two of many station masters who aided the passage of hundreds and even thousands to safety. This pair was unusual, only in that each had at one time kept careful records. Robert Purvis, an African-American leader of the Philadelphia UGRR, also kept a logbook of slaves passing through his headquarters until his family persuaded him to destroy the records after passage of the Fugitive Slave Law. Blacks working for the UGRR were much more vulnerable than whites in the slavery wars and took greater risk in keeping and hiding secret records. Even if blacks contributed more significantly to the UGRR, a lack of documentation is not surprising, even understandable. One black UGRR participant did keep count. Frederick Douglass made his Rochester home available to fugitives on the run. Nearly 400 Canada-bound slaves found temporary refuge with Douglass during the decade leading up to the Civil War. The Reverend Germain Logan, another former fugitive who became an important spokesperson for his black community, played a similar role in his hometown of Syracuse, sheltering more than 1,500 slaves in his home or at his church. Democratic and radical impulses defined the revolutionary generation that founded America. The egalitarian ideals of abolitionist activists, especially UGRR agents, were perceived as a tribute to the country's founding generation. Promoters of the Liberty Lines echoed the sentiments of Americans' founders, impassioned opposition to tyranny and oppression. A participant characterized his involvement in the UGRR on the dedication page of his memoir. To the millions of happy grandchildren of a generation fast leaving the stage of action, and who must get their knowledge of the rebellion, the Civil War, and its causes from the lips of those who saw and participated, or from the pages of history, as we, the grandparents, got ours of the revolution from those long since passed away, and from the written records of that thrilling period, this little volume of unique but wonderful history is sincerely and most affectionately dedicated by one of the grandfathers. Blacks embraced these patriotic themes. James Pennington, a fugitive slave who became a minister, argued in 1831 that our fathers were among the first that peopled this country. Their sweat and their tears have been the means in a measure of raising our country to its present standing. Many of them fought and bled and died for the gaining of her liberties. Pennington and other firebrand black abolitionists demanded that they become part of the pluribus of E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one, the motto on the Great Seal of the United States. They desired America to become in reality a land of the free. To that end, radicals advocated civil disobedience, especially in regard to fugitive slaves. Thus, the UGRR was a full-fledged grassroots resistance movement, representing the true national goals of democracy and liberty. It is hard to date the birth of this movement, but fugitives themselves made telling observations. William Wells Brown, an ex-slave who fled from St. Louis in 1834, suggested that when he made his escape, there was no underground railroad. African Americans believed that before the 1840s, the North Star was in many instances the only friend that the weary and footsore fugitive found. When Southern bounty hunters began aggressive campaigns in the North, seizing free blacks as well as fugitive slaves, ordinary citizens, not just Quaker radicals or Methodist zealots, joined in to protest kidnappings. They created vigilance committees to prevent these startling and random abductions. In November 1835, 100 citizens formed the Vigilance Committee of New York City. In 1838, an equally dynamic group, spearheaded by its black officers Robert Purvis and Jacob White, organized in Philadelphia. These groups pledged to protect free blacks from slavery's net, in the streets and in the courts. They soon shifted focus, and vigilance committees became not just shields against pro-slavery kidnappers, but groups willing to offer assistance to fugitives in transit. As time went by, these groups broadened again, to support and even enlist the flight of slaves to freedom, and evolved into the backbone of a loosely organized UGRR. The UGRR became a vast tangle of interconnected networks dedicated to rescuing African Americans from slavery and shepherding them to freedom. Naturally, there was no national organization, election of officers, or advertisement of activities. The group carried out dangerous and clandestine operations, using code words to protect their identities. Eventually, UGRR station masters, conductors, and elaborate transportation schemes for cargo supplemented the North Star during the years leading up to the Civil War. An intrepid volunteer army of underground agents blossomed. Their commitment to deliver slaves from bondage proved a remarkable crusade. Very few took a public stand, especially because of the clandestine nature of their work. Some emerged as heroes by fighting battles in the courts, but most carried on their activities anonymously and undetected. Agents of the UGRR not only strengthened the anti-slavery movement, but the radical threat they posed hastened the coming of the Civil War. The vast majority of these UGRR agents never visited the South. Indeed, most conductors conveyed slaves from one specific depot only to the next depot on a Liberty Line, not all the way to freedom. The very few who ventured into the South to extract slaves were often called abductors by their contemporaries. This was to distinguish them from the vast majority of conductors who guided fugitives on very limited segments of their journey. Abductors were a highly skilled and rare breed of UGRR conductor. Only a handful gained any notoriety before Harriet Tubman came onto the UGRR scene, all of them white men. Their activities became known because they were caught abducting in flagrante, which, in all but one case, curtailed their UGRR careers. In 1844, a Massachusetts sea captain, Jonathan Walker, was detained offshore in Florida with a boatload of fugitives. Walker was caught in the act of assisting runaway slaves as he used the open seas as an escape route. Convicted by a Pensacola jury, Walker was first locked into a pillory, where he was pelted with rotten eggs. Then he was given excessive fines and forced to serve nearly a year in jail, until anti-slavery friends could raise enough cash to secure his release. But the punishment for which he became infamous was what was branded on his right hand by a U.S. Marshal, the mark SS for slave stealer, a term white Southerners used as an epithet to identify those who assisted fugitives. John Greenleaf Whittier composed a poem in tribute to Walker's heroic scarification, which ended with the verse, "Then lift that manly right hand, bold, plowman of the wave. Its branded palm shall prophesy salvation to the slave." The three other most prominent abductor conductors of the era were also white: John Fairfield, Charles Torrey, and Calvin Fairbank. John Fairfield was the most unusual of the three. The son of a slaveholder, he renounced his birthright to spend his time and energy liberating slaves, assisting them to Canada. He operated very independently, mainly moving through Cincinnati on his trips north. His activities were well known to the famed Indiana UGRR leader, Levi Coffin, although Coffin disapproved of Fairfield's daredevil techniques. Fairfield was arrested several times during his UGRR activities and twice broke out of jail. He was always ready to take money for his services from the slaves if they had it to offer, but if they did not, he helped them all the same. As his reputation grew, blacks in Canada would proffer their savings and beg him to undertake a specific rescue on their behalf, something that proved increasingly dangerous, but a vocation at which he excelled. Charles Torrey, a Yale-educated Congregational minister, resigned his post at a church in Providence in 1838 to become committed full-time to abolitionism. He became an anti-slavery editor in Albany, but eventually shifted his operations to the Washington, D.C. area, where he actively pursued the rescue of slaves. He was caught transporting a slave family out of Virginia in 1843 and sentenced to 6 years hard labor in a Maryland penitentiary. He wrote to an abolitionist friend, "If I am a guilty man, I am a very guilty one, for I have aided nearly 400 slaves to escape to freedom, the greater part of whom would probably, but for my exertions, have died in prison." Torrey himself died after only 2 years in jail and became a martyr to the cause. Equally infamous, the Reverend Calvin Fairbank learned to hate slavery while a student at Oberlin College in Ohio. By 1837, he began making trips into Kentucky to transport slaves to freedom, helping them cross the Ohio River. He enlisted an assistant, Delia Webster, a white schoolteacher from Vermont. In 1844, the two were arrested for helping a woman and child escape. Webster went free, but Fairbank was sentenced to 15 years in jail for his role in slave stealing. He was pardoned in 1849, but arrested again for UGRR activities and sent to prison again, serving 12 of his 15 years. Fairbank confided that he was whipped repeatedly during his prison terms. He too became a symbol of resistance and sacrifice to the UGRR faithful. Over his years with the UGRR, Fairbank had smuggled nearly 50 slaves to freedom, beginning with a 15-year-old girl who was adopted into the family of the esteemed UGRR leader, Levi Coffin. Fairbank spirited the girl away from her 80-year-old master in Montgomery County, Kentucky. "She was the fifth in direct descent from her master," he later wrote, "being the great-great-great-granddaughter of a slave whom he took as his mistress at the age of 14. And now he was expecting to make this girl his mistress." This kind of sensational revelation became standard abolitionist fare. While all these men gained notoriety with their abductions during the 1830s and 1840s, their careers could not match the fame that Tubman accrued with her string of rescues during the 1850s, especially because she was operating after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Law. Not only was she one of the most intrepid abductors, her status as a fugitive guaranteed her more acclaim than any of her rivals. Also, the fact that she was never caught enhanced her reputation. Levi Coffin became the most famous station master within the UGRR. He had learned the ropes of assisting fugitives as a young man by working with his cousins Vestal and Addison Coffin, who operated out of North Carolina. He explained, "These outlying slaves knew where I lived, and when reduced to extremity of want or danger, often came to my room, in the silence and darkness of the night, to obtain food or assistance." By 1826, Levi and his wife, Catherine, moved to Indiana, settling near the town of Newport. The Coffin's two-story brick home became a major depot for three Liberty Lines. They used their basement to conceal fugitives, and their horse and wagon were nearly always hitched and ready to go. Coffin recalled in his 1876 memoir, "We knew not what night or what hour of the night we would be roused from slumber by a gentle rap at the door. When they, fugitives, were all safely inside and the door fastened, I would cover the windows, strike a light, and build a good fire. By this time, my wife would be up and preparing victuals for them, and in a short time, the cold and hungry fugitives would be made comfortable. The fugitives would rest on pallets before the fire the rest of the night. Frequently, wagon loads of passengers from the different lines have met at our house, having no previous knowledge of each other. The companies varied in number, from 2 or 3 fugitives to 17. The lit lamp at John Rankin's Hilltop home in Ripley, Ohio, equally symbolized the impressive constellation of clandestine operations fanning out from this UGRR hub. Many stations or depots employed the usual hiding places, potato cellars, attics, barns. Some station masters created hidden rooms, secret tunnels, and fake closets. Scores of brave and committed UGRR agents from the border states of Kentucky and Indiana to the far reaches of Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and even Vermont risked their lives to safeguard refugee slaves. Nearly every northern state from Michigan to Maine can boast some remnants of the Liberty Lines connecting abolitionists from one outpost to the next. Over the 1850s, Harriet Tubman would become familiar with scores of UGRR depots scattered across the Upper South and the North. She recalled visiting stations in the following Delaware towns: Blackbird, Camden, Dover, Laurel, Middleton, Newcastle, and of course, Wilmington. When she began ferrying fugitives to Canada, she became more familiar with depots in upstate New York, such as Quaker James Canning Fuller's home, Evergreen, near the town of Skaneateles. By the 1850s, hundreds and eventually thousands of whites who were morally opposed to slavery began to contemplate active resistance. In the North, religious and secular associations organized boycotts against slave products. Free produce stores sprang up in New England towns and cities. Agricultural societies, for example, promoted raising beets for sugar to decrease dependence on cane crops harvested by slaves. Volunteers solicited funds to underwrite vigilance committees, and women's groups gathered food and clothing for refugees in need. All of this was standard charitable practice. But a new breed of anti-slavery leader, notably philanthropist Gerrit Smith, did more. Smith began as a reform-minded businessman, but converted into a radical abolitionist firebrand and Liberty Party politician. He became a defiant and outspoken critic of the slave power when elected to Congress. Smith's father, a Utica store owner, was a partner with John Jacob Astor. When his father retired in 1818, the 21-year-old Gerrit inherited an impressive financial empire worth nearly $400,000. He took over not just the family store, but thousands of acres of land in Oneida County, as well as vast acreage around Oswego and throughout the Adirondacks. He was a man of great wealth and influence in his upstate home of Peterborough. During the Panic of 1837, Smith lost nearly all his money, and facing a mountain of debt, he moved from his ancestral mansion into a more modest home, the Grove. He hoped that when my debts are paid, I shall have a heart to reduce myself, if not to a poor man, by purchasing the liberty of the enslaved poor. In 1841, Smith purchased a slave family of seven from Kentucky, settling them into freedom. This practice was frowned upon by many abolitionists, who felt payment for slaves, even to emancipate them, acknowledged the legitimacy of human bondage. But Smith defended his actions as a humanitarian. During financial reversals, Smith had shrewdly held on to most of his real estate, thousands of acres of land, which later made him a multimillionaire. Over his long philanthropic career, Smith gave away the equivalent of $600 million in contemporary sums. Between 1846 and 1850, Smith donated 200,000 acres of land to black and poor farmers. John Brown was among those who settled on one of Smith's charity tracts. Black abolitionist Henry Highland Garnet took refuge in Smith's Peterborough home, which had become a magnet for those seeking support. Harriet Tubman was a frequent guest and consulted with him about her anti-slavery activities and UGRR career. Smith received a letter from an anti-slavery friend in Tennessee who wanted him to buy a slave maimed by whipping and carried indelible evidence of severe punishment on his person. This abolitionist thought Smith might want to have this living exhibit to put on display at abolitionist meetings in the North, a scarred body to win converts to the cause. Smith turned this proposition down, but was part of a growing cadre of abolitionists who were not afraid to use sensationalist publicity to advance an abolitionist agenda. Yankee propagandists mounted public campaigns to champion both the cause of emancipation and the plight of the fugitive. The very symbol of the American Anti-Slavery Society was a black male shackled, arms upraised, pleading, "Am I not a man and a brother?" The idea of putting a maimed slave on display was rejected by Smith, but at the same